Hey, folks, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guests, just want to let you know I'm going to be in Phoenix, Arizona, May 3rd through the 6th at the House of Comedy. Come on out if you're in the area, hang out. Great, great place, great club. Before we get to my guests this week, I just wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, take a quick second and go to iTunes and leave some nice comments if you're happy with the podcast and you're enjoying it on iTunes. It helps. It draws new listeners. And it's always nice to have a good rating on iTunes. Just take a second. If you're not enjoying it or you don't like it, go leave your negative comments somewhere else. Maybe social media. That's what it exists for. And as you know, I live in New York City, and I'm at the point where nothing fazes me anymore. There was a rat running down the street the other day with a whole green apple in its mouth. And normally I'd be like, oh, that's gross. Instead, I'm like, good for him. He's eating healthy. He's working out. He had his little Lululemon pants on. He was really going for it. The city's just gotten nuts because there's construction everywhere. You can't walk and not hear something that just goes right through your brain. So I went to deepdiscount.com. Now listen, yes, I'm talking about my sponsor again. They're important to the show. The sponsorship helps me pay for the expenses to put the show out to you guys. So I really appreciate it. If you consider them, go check them out. Go to deepdiscount.com, support them, because in supporting them, you're supporting me. You can get to them by going to my website, paulmercurio.com homepage, click on the deepdiscount.com link and go check out their site. They've got TV shows, movies that you can own forever, great discounts, low prices, cool electronics. I bought a pair of noise-canceling headphones, which I'm using now, Sony, awesome, cheap, inexpensive. Walk around the city, I don't hear all that noise. I wear them in my house. I tune out the family. Yeah, now when my kid's annoying me, I don't have to wish he'd walk into the woods and never come back. I just put on the headphones. Downside is, I had the headphones on and my wife was asking me something and I just said yes, and apparently I agreed to vacuum the house for a week. But go to deepdiscount.com. You're going to find amazing deals, movies you should own and watch when you want. Braveheart, Gladiator, Godfather movies, which are my favorite, okay? You'll find classics from back in the day, hard-to-find titles, and new releases, too. Out this week, 12 Strong, starring Chris Hemsworth in the declassified true story of U.S. Special Forces team deployed to Afghanistan in the weeks following 9/11. Get your copy now on Blu-ray or DVD for a great price at deepdiscount.com. Look, like I said, go to my homepage, paulmercurio.com, click the logo, be good to yourself, buy your favorites. Support my sponsor. Support me. Come on. I'm worth it. I'm adorable. Thank you, Deep Discount. And thank you guys, too. Enjoy John Frankel, my guest coming up. Correspondent on the award-winning Real Sports with Brian Gumbel on HBO. Really cool conversation with John. Enjoy it. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us this week. Very, very excited to have my next guest on, who I actually met a couple of times briefly. I'm not sure if we'll remember, but John Frankel, correspondent on HBO's Real Sports, which is currently airing on Tuesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on HBO. It's great to have you on the show, John. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Good to talk sports.
Yeah, we met. I was doing a short HBO kind of sports comedy series when Ross Greenberg was there. And I had met you very briefly. You probably wouldn't remember. I came by the studios when you were all shooting that time of year and said hello. And just been a big, big fan of the show for a long time because I used to work on The Daily Show and work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert now, but I kind of took that model of sort of skewering the news to sports and using satire to do it, kind of looking at things off the field with a satirical view. And so I always admired how you guys sort of, dig down into the real aspects of the sports world beyond the field, and you do it really, really well.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate that, and you're spreading the word. And I think I misspoke when I said it's always nice talking sports because, as you know, and you've just stated, that our show, yes, has its genesis in sports, but we so often, I think, transcend the world of sports and touch on so many relevant issues.
Well, yeah, and it's also important because, you know, life is in the gray areas, and, I have my son is really into sports, and, God bless the professional sports worlds and world and all of that, but they do like to portray things a certain way sometimes. And I think it's important for not just adults, but young kids to see sports for what they really are. And a good example of that is something that people can see on HBO Go right now, which is a piece you did on the, for lack of a better term, sort of abuse by some NCAA football programs regarding, you know, their treatment and care for athletes. And I'd love you to talk about that a little bit because it's a really compelling piece.
Sure. We have addressed this issue before and through various means. We've done a piece about the mental pressures and the abuse of athletes. We've done it on the physical pressures. We've done it through the aspect and the eyes of trainers for these teams and team doctors who essentially are, you know, the handlers, if you will, for the coaches.
Right.
And we decided to take all of it and revisit some of it and address the issue at large, because one of the big things, one of the headlines that comes out of it is that there was a scale that's called the Tepper scale, which was designed by a professor who's at Ohio State, which obviously has one of the most successful collegiate athletic programs across the board. And the NCAA uses his scale in a survey with its own athletes. And what they were coming back with at the time when they still published it, which they do not any longer, that college, amateur college athletes were the most abused workers in America.
Wow.
And that's up against industries such as the medical profession, engineering, the military, education, you name it, healthcare, all professional industries. And none of the numbers came back as drastic, as severe as they were in amateur college athletics.
What were the metrics, by the way, in the scale? Like, sort of, how were they measuring that, and why isn't it published anymore? Is it because it's too controversial and it doesn't make them look good, I assume? Or
I think that's what it is. I mean, we can only assume that.
Right.
That after we did our last piece, they stopped publishing, but they didn't stop conducting it. You know, and it asks about all sorts of things, but it generally is trying to determine, in many cases, sort of the power imbalance between employer and employee, or in this case, coach, student, athlete. And you know, it touches in all areas, which is not just the scale, but the piece addresses things such as, one of the big ones is time. So by the NCAA's own guidebook, the rules stipulate that student athletes can't spend more than 20 hours with their coaches in their sports.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's even at the Division III level, and I don't mean to say even in dismissive way, but at schools where there's probably a greater balance between academics and athletics, that the amount of time required of these students is far exceeding the 20 hours.
Yeah.
It's nearly double, and in some cases touching on 50 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not having time to study, forget that, socialize, or even get the right amount of sleep that they need.
Right.
And one of the things was also we looked at it, we'd done this piece in terms of mental health. And the athletes, college athletes, come in with sort of a greater measure of mental health, if you will. They're happier. They're the big people on campus. They've just been recruited out of high school and such. And so generally, they rank higher than the general student body. But very quickly, by the end of their first semester, they're already into a downward trend.
In terms of the academics?
In terms of their mental health.
Oh, just the stresses of it all, yeah.
And the depression and such, that there are so many demands put on them. And it's not just, as you might think, football and basketball. We have interviewed people in other sports, volleyball, gymnastics, women's gymnastics, track and field athletes, as noted in our piece, Ebony Moore, who was at Temple University, and, you know, reached a breaking point because the coach, as she said, constantly, you know, threatening to send her home, take away her scholarship, telling her to lose weight. If she didn't perform, there was no place for her there. And that, you know, that wears on you. I mean,
so here, yeah, absolutely.
Constantly told you, you know, it's no different than saying, you know, you've got to meet a quota. Here's your sales target each month.
Mm-hmm.
And ask somebody who works in healthcare, who's in pharmaceutical sales or anything like that, and how much stress that puts on them when they get to, you know, August 26th,
right.
They haven't hit their number.
Right. I mean, you know, what's shocking and not shocking to me is, you know, somebody in that situation, or, you know, in the piece that I referred to, Colby Listenby, who had a pelvic injury and he was supposed to need at least 8 weeks to recover, and they pushed him back out 3 weeks in, and now he's got pins in his pelvic area and he can't really play. And as you saying, the PC probably won't make it to the NFL. Are there not people or places that they can go to in the administration to say, hey, look, or the parents of these kids, and say, look, this is unreasonable. I'm being forced to do something I shouldn't do. And so that isn't there no oversight in most of these programs of the coaching staff, or is the administration culpable most of the time?
I think if my opinion is that the administration is culpable most of the time. And it's for this reason, that there is, coaches are judged, as we all know, on one thing and one thing only, wins and losses.
Right.
And that's whether you're talking about big time college football or women's gymnastics at a Division III school, Division II school, and certainly a Division I school. You name the sport, that's it.
Mm.
I mean, they say that, okay, we're looking at graduation rates and so forth, and,
right.
you know,
right.
Show me a coach that was fired with that as the only reason that they were
right.
fired.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's happened, but I've never heard of such a case.
Yeah.
So they're judged on one thing only, and it's wins and losses. So the administration buckles to that.
Yeah.
Right? They want these teams to win.
Yeah, because you got you got the boosters complaining, hey, you're not winning, we're not going to write you checks. It's all tied into
it.
Right?
And that's what it is. It all comes back to money. I recently spoke to somebody who actually went to my high school but lives down in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just catching up, and he was telling me that his daughter goes to the University of Alabama. And he said when she started there, he wouldn't have, you know, maybe he wouldn't have said it was the greatest academic institution that that he knew of.
Mm.
But he said the improvement in her time there, and since Nick Saban has been there, the hundreds of millions of dollars that have come in through donations, the number of buildings that have gone up.
Really?
And this guy, who's a really smart guy, was saying, Nick Saban is worth every penny of his salary and 10 times it.
Wow. Yeah. So,
you know, and so you take that and you tell a college president, an athletic director,
right?
You know, and if it's one student, your initial thought might be, oh, that's a one-off case. Look, in their defense, and I will say this, that college coaches, what might be abuse to one is motivating for another.
Right? Yeah, no, it's a good.
There's always those kids that don't mind getting grabbed by the face mask, need a kick in the putt in the pants, need to be yelled and screamed at in order to perform, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know that works for them and for others. Now, if there's a regular pattern of behavior that crosses that line,
right.
Then you've got a problem.
Well, you know, I wonder too, especially in the Colby case, is this one and done culture now contributing to this? I'm not making an excuse for the coaches, but they got to win and they got to win now, right? So if I'm a coach and it was 25, 30 years ago and my star has got this injury, I'm going to give him the 8 weeks. If he's only good for half the season, it doesn't matter. We'll come back the next two or three seasons and we'll win a championship. But now this kid, and he should, right? You know, if he's got his chance to be one and done this year, I'm going to lose this. This time next year, my kid's gone. I got to get him out there and I got to win games. How much of that is contributing to this? And again, I'm not making an excuse for the coaches, but is that a factor?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's a factor. You know, this is what I get out of him.
Yeah.
But the other problem here, and to be fair, they've also made an investment. They've spent money recruiting him. They've given him or her a scholarship.
Right.
And that counts. Like they have their bank.
Right.
But the other factor here, especially with physical injuries and even with mental, is that the schools aren't on the hook after the kid leaves school.
Yeah.
So they don't need to worry about abusing a player physically.
Because there's 50, 60 more kids in line who want to, waiting to get
it. Not only that, not only can go to the next kid, right?
Yeah.
But And by the way, they're more likely to not push the kid who's a third stringer because they don't need him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, okay, fine, whatever. Or a second stringer. Let's assume you're a scholarship and you're too deep on the football roster.
Right.
You know, you might not be as inclined to push that kid because he's not as good as the All-American.
Right.
The All-American you need on the field.
Right.
But what I was trying to say is that All-American, whether he goes to the NFL or it's a female athlete who might not even have a pro career after, but they don't have to take care of their medical
right.
concerns after that.
Yeah,
there's
no collective bargaining agreement. There's no
right.
right. There's no. But isn't this where the NCAA as a body should be stepping in? I mean, they know if you know this exists, and you now because of you, and thankfully because of you in the show, we know this exists. They certainly knew it existed even before, you know, you started to uncover this. I would imagine. Is it again go back to money and they don't want to upset the apple cart? And if they start putting regulation, not about the post career, but like sort of this kind of thing with Colby, for example, that happened and these other situations where these kids are rushed back and then just cast aside.
Well, I think some of it is heart. Some of it is what's in their guidelines, in their bylaws,
mm-hmm.
in this 400-page volume.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it sort of just lacks compassion and heart.
Right.
So, for example, in our story that you're referencing, we talk about a young man named Derek Shealy,
mm-hmm.
who was playing at Frostburg State University and ended up with a head injury, severe head injury, and collapsed and died.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, the school gave the parents no hint of what was going on. Fortunately, they got an anonymous letter from a teammate sometime afterwards, and then they approached the school and they sort of began to cop to it, and eventually they did win a lawsuit against the coaches and the school, and they took that money and they donated it to a foundation that they had started.
Mm-hmm.
But as they say, they never once got a letter from the NCAA. Not once.
So how? Like, isn't there anything in there? There's not, maybe it's written in a volume, but it's not, there's no real oversight? Is that what's going on?
I can give you another example that's not in our story. And so I'm not going to, it was part of our research, and I'm not going to give names and name the institution.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an example of student athletes in a sport where there was an assistant coach who was upset by what the coach was seeing. And she began to document it. She went to the administration of the school, got no response, essentially, was told that they would conduct an investigation, but they didn't even ask her for her notes.
Mm.
That person then left the university,
mm-hmm.
went to the NCAA, and the NCAA said, nothing we can do. We cannot intervene. That's not our jurisdiction, essentially, to get involved in coaching matters like that.
What? That's...
Yeah.
Does this ever change them? Because like this issue of the NCAA, and this goes back a long time, and you guys have done a great job sort of shedding light on this. How does this change? Does this change, or is the institution too entrenched and too big, and the money too powerful to ever really affect any change?
It's the money.
Yeah.
There's too much money being made.
Yeah.
No one's gonna rob the nest. And you're not just talking. And in this case, it's not, I wish I could say, oh, it's only the NCAA, right? They're responsible. So are the member institutions of the NCAA. But it's everybody who televises the events, everybody who's making money off the backs of televising, broadcasting, radio, podcasting.
Yeah, you look at the
NFL.
Right. right. You look at the NFL with the head issue, kid trauma, and, you know, how it's taken years for that to kind of properly be addressed, and some argue it still isn't. You're right. It just is very corrupting on a lot of levels. One of the things I really admire about the work that you do is you will live in the gray areas, which I think, as I said, how life works, meaning, you know, you'll sort of show the good and the bad side of things. And you did a documentary called Hellfighters, terrific doc. And there was a review done by Newsday of it, and it said the surest sign that John Frankel is making a serious film is how he portrays the team's coach, Duke Ferguson. In Hollywood's version, he would be an inspirational figure played by Denzel Washington, backed by a string orchestra. In this one, he's a complex and mysterious person. Inspirational, yes, but also occasionally irrational and irresponsible. And I think as a journalist, that's a high compliment. It seems that's something, because I've other things that I've watched you do, it's very, very prominent in all of your pieces. That's obviously a conscious thing that you do, I imagine.
Well, I think, as my father-in-law would like to say to me, he goes, why do you always do unhappy things? listen, I remember the Titans, citing Denzel Washington playing the coach. Remember the Titans is one of my favorite all-time films.
Right.
I watch that,
right.
24/7.
Right.
But I just think that there's life, and real life things don't end up perfect.
Right.
We all know that.
Right.
And in the case of Hellfighters and that work, that was one of the most satisfying things I've done, only because it was what I would call a process piece, mm-hmm. where I followed that team,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm.
So I was learning the story,
mm-hmm.
and at times you have to check yourself, because your training, if you will, is as a journalist, so to ask questions and such. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, is a documentary about dotting my I's and crossing my T's and checking my facts and everything you hear doing, or is a documentary what presents itself in front of the camera as I shoot?
Mm.
And I wrestled with that and went back and forth. And there were times when I did make calls and did some research, but I really tried to let the story unfold as it was. And in fact, in that situation, I remember that at the end of the day, Coach Ferguson wasn't too pleased with me. And he said, well, you made the film you wanted to make. And my response was, no, I made the film I saw.
Yeah.
And I really do believe that in my heart.
Yeah.
And I never, I never asked somebody to wait, hold on, I got to get to the end of the sidewalk before you walk.
Right.
Or can you go back and walk again? Because the minute I did that, that means I'm influencing the film, and that if I cast doubt, then somebody might ask, well, did he do it in that situation? Did he do it in that situation?
Right. Right.
What else did he make up or redo?
Right.
And I think that that's true about real sports as well, too. It's a little bit different. Often we've done so much of our reporting off camera. And when we go into a situation.
Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean off camera you've done your reporting?
Meaning we've, our producers who are the bread and butter to our team and our show, they have done extensive research on stories, and they've made sure what it is we're going to go hear and find out, because otherwise there's too much, to be honest. I mean, there's too much time, there's too much energy invested, there's too much money invested for us to just, we can't do a real sports piece the way I did Hellfighters. I shot 175 hours.
Right. Yeah.
We don't have that luxury.
Yeah. You'd be getting calls from the brass at HBO. What are you doing? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so we know often, but we're asking questions and you hear things that you might not have heard. And so you'll go with that. I don't want to say we know the story with the minute we walk out the door, but we have a pretty good idea when we're reporting on something, and we feel good about it because we have done the reporting on the story. And so but I do think that the format, because we're 15 minutes or 16 minutes, and oftentimes now more recently, our pieces are even longer than that, that yes, you can see the narrative and you see the arc in the story, and you come away usually thinking one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we also, because of the format and the time that we're given to tell a story, I do think that there is nuance or gray, as you say, and we can allow the viewer to make up their own mind at times. And I believe in that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you have to give the viewer the benefit of the doubt, that they can reach their own conclusions and don't have to be spoon fed. And for people who don't know, Hellfighters is about the Harlem Hellfighters, who try to prove that, they should become Harlem's high school football team. And it sort of follows their struggle to obtain funding and gain permission to play. And it's a really interesting look in how complex one thing can be that you think, it's high school football. It's pretty straightforward.
And I'll tell you, you're nice to bring up Hellfighters, and I'm sorry I didn't. you threw out a softball, and I didn't hit it out of the park.
No.
I didn't tell people what the story was about. But essentially, Ferguson is a guy who played in the NFL in the late 70s, was going, living in Harlem, trying to do some economic development, stumbles across the fact that none of the 14 high schools in Harlem have football teams. In fact, there's only two schools on the island, public schools on the island of Manhattan, that do play football, and that's Stuyvesant and George Washington High School at the time, and most of the Attleboro schools, or a lot of them, have teams. And so Duke started out as a sandlot team and then got some funding through the NFL that helped support former players that get into coaching, and he got help from the Jets and such, and donation of equipment. And he put this together, and then with some political muscle behind him, gets admitted to the public schools athletic league, which was obviously breaking with the mold of one school, one team.
Mm-hmm.
He could go and get kids. And I give Duke all the credit in the world for coming up with this idea, wanting to be a male figure in these kids' lives, for a lot of whom did not have a male figure. And he showed up every day. But there were so many other factors and things where he dropped the ball and didn't want to take help, and where people wanted to help him.
Mm.
And so as a result, things just didn't get done as smoothly as possible. And he bent a lot of rules, and he was very litigious and such.
Mm.
But again, you know, you can either say, you know, it's like that old song, I'd rather live in your world without, you know, with you than, you know, my world without you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say, I'm going to play high school football the way Duke plays football, or I cannot play football, period.
Right.
And
right.
What was ultimately better for these kids.
Right. And why did you decide to do it as a doc and not, you know, a piece on HBO Real Sports?
A Real Sports as well. Yeah. Coincidentally, as it happens, I was still working at CBS. I was a correspondent for the early show program with Bryant.
Mm-hmm.
When I first read a story about the Hellfighters, Harvey Arreton of the New York Times had written a column about Duke and the team. And
mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, I either want to go volunteer for this team and help coach, or I called a buddy of mine, one of the producers at Real Sports, one of the senior producers, and I said, you guys got to do this story. And neither happened. I didn't volunteer, and they didn't do a story. But shortly after that, oh man, maybe it wasn't so shortly, I was coming out of the subway with my son, and I see this gentleman carrying a bag that says Hellfighters.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, are you that coach? Da, 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 da. And then it turned out that his team, which I had never put two and two together, was practicing on a field in Harlem every time after my son was playing T-ball at the time. And they always saw this group of kids gathering to wait to play on the field.
Mm.
And it turned out that was them. And
I said,
and so I wasn't at Real Sports at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never shot a film, and I barely held a camera. I mean, occasionally when I went out with crews.
Right.
But I went through the whole process of, you know, going and buying my own camera, and took me three tries to figure out what kind of bag I needed to easily. No, at one point I had something on rollers. I was like, well, this is going to work when I'm trying to follow them on the subway.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I would go off until literally 10, 11 o'clock at night sometimes after practice and follow the kids home.
Wow.
Such, and my wife would have no idea where I was.
Yeah. But that's great. I mean, I'm sure you were able to kind of get a much fuller story out of it. You know, the there's two stories that jump out too that you've done, which was the portrait of Kevin Turner, who battled ALS. And this speaks to me sort of the way you tell the story, sort of, you know, you didn't just focus on him in his state of ALS, worst state of ALS, but sort of followed the progression of it, and that made it really impactful. And I wonder, you know, we talked about being objective and an objective journalist, and as a documentary filmmaker, not inserting yourself into the story or trying to affect the story. But how are you affected by these stories as and after you report them personally? Because, you know, some of them are, you know, pretty heavy, you know.
Sure. It takes its toll.
Mm.
And I don't mean I'm struggling and such, but it I feel.
Yeah.
Some people, I just participated in a panel discussion last week with somebody a couple of journalists who have written extensively about CTE and concussions and head trauma and such. and the NFL. And at one point, I acknowledged that I cried when I did the story with Kevin Turner. Mm. And I'd gotten to know Kevin very well because I'd started out following him doing a film, and then that transitioned into an HBO Real Sports piece as well. And so I knew Kevin for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And got to be good friends with him and his parents and his best friend, who I even text to this day. I mean, 2 days ago we were texting.
And now let me just ask you something. As a journalist, is that appropriate? Should you be doing that? Or is that like, it's just you can't help it because you're so deep into the story?
I think that there is a way to... I think there are always... As you go through the process, there are times when you ask yourself, can I do this? Should I do this? And you have to make up your mind in the moment.
Right.
So, for example, when I was shooting with Kevin alone before it became a Real Sports piece, there were times when he needed help putting on a belt or pulling up a pair of pants. Mm-hmm. And I would help him. Mm-hmm. There were moments, in fact, two specifically, when I thought about, should I shoot it? Should I shoot myself? Should I put the camera on a tripod or a windowsill?
Right.
And shoot myself helping him. Mm. And in the first instance, I don't do it. Mm. And for whatever reason, the second time I said, you know what? I'll just shoot it. If I ever want to use it, I can. At least I have that option. But if I don't shoot it, then I never have that option.
Right.
And I didn't want to be part of the story.
Right.
And in fact, there's a scene in the film that I do with Kevin that I don't think was not in our actual Real Sports piece, but at one point, and I'm in a hotel room with his best friend, Craig Sanderson, and Kevin, and we're actually in Dallas at the Super Bowl in 2011, and Kevin is shaving, and it's very difficult to, he had a tough time shaving.
Yeah.
With ALS. But he's doing it, and I'm shooting in a way so that you can't see me. But at a certain point, he starts laughing to himself. Mm. And I said something like, what are you laughing at, or do you need a hand? And he says, oh, I'm just laughing. He says, it makes me think about when you see those commercials to raise money for those kids who are starving in Ethiopia. And you see the camera, and you know the cameraman's there because he's shooting it, and you ask yourself, why doesn't the cameraman just give him some candy? And it was just this wonderful, wonderful moment of Kevin humanizing the host. And that's when I said, do you need a hand?
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm okay.
Yeah.
But Craig and I were cracking up.
Oh, that's great.
I'm trying to shoot this through the mirror.
Right. Go ahead.
So, yes, I feel, and yet this panel discussion, to circle back, somebody else who had written for the New York Times about this said, well, I couldn't feel. I have to base it on facts, and I'm the data guy, and I'm a this.
Like,
there's no crying in softball.
Right, right.
And I'm like, no, there is. There is empathy.
Yeah.
And maybe that's my way of being a good journalist, not a good journalist. I don't want to pat myself on the back. That's my way of being the journalist that I am.
Yeah, and by the way, people are going to get there on their own anyway. Okay, like I do stand up, right? And when I like to talk to people in the audience, and I like to interview people, and as my part of my podcast, obviously. And my rule of thumb is I'm like a middle class kid from Providence, Rhode Island. So my rule of thumb is if I'm thinking it, 99% of the people in the room are thinking it. And so, if you're talking to somebody and something doesn't smell right, so you call them out on it in a fun way, it's always honest. And so my point is, I think it's okay for you to show that empathy because the people are feeling it anyway. I mean, a perfect example in the Kevin piece was he's at the stage where he can't speak, so he has to basically type with his eyes. And he says, it must be difficult. Something to the effect you say, like, it must be difficult for you to not be able to speak. And he goes, yeah, it's tough. It's really hard to be the smartest person in the room and not be able to talk. Hilarious. Like, I didn't see that coming. And it burst the bubble a little bit. It took the air out of it.
It disarms you.
Yeah. It was great. It was great.
Yeah. And he had that. I mean, humor was what he was a funny guy when he was perfectly healthy, as I he heard from many people. And he maintained that sense of humor, and I think it helped a lot of people be around him. But, I had another friend who, about 6 weeks ago, took his own life, a former All-American at Syracuse, and played 7 years in the NFL, a guy named Chris Gedney.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I cried.
Yeah.
I cried, and I was angry. And I'm angry, you know, one, that he felt that he had no other options. And I'm angry because not just Chris and Kevin and other guys that I know who now have ALS, but I'm watching too many guys who played a game that I loved and a game that I've watched, and again, whether I know them or not, they're being wrecked. They're being ravaged by this game that they love.
Yeah.
Most of them, you know, would tell you they'd do it again.
Right.
But that doesn't take away the pain and the sting of what's going on and what's happening.
And the importance of trying to take care of these people as well. Just as we wrap up, there's one more thing, if you don't mind, I want to ask you about. You did a profile of Ronda Rousey in 2013, I believe. You know, she's at the top of the mountain. And did you, and then, you know, obviously she, you know, lost her crown and all of that. Did you see any signs then of any chink in the armor that she could sort of, you know, was it within a 2 or 3 years kind of just, you know, be out of the conversation like this?
I think that as a trained cynic, or learned cynic, that, you know, everybody is a retired athlete, and most of us sooner than others.
Yeah.
And so you can be Joe Montana or you can be Ronda Rousey, but at some point you're going to be retired.
Yeah.
And I think for Ronda, it happened much sooner than she anticipated.
Yeah.
Though I think she was smart enough to recognize that she should take advantage of the opportunities that presented themselves outside of the ring.
Right.
So that while she had her fame, to get into movies, to get into other things and make a buck.
Yeah.
And so she did that. It's a shame. I guess now she's doing some wrestling, and I don't think anybody anticipated the rapid fall.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think everybody saw her as so dominant. Well, but I'm guessing that while she looked to take advantage of her celebrity and leverage that to make money, it also distracted her from being what made her as good as she was in the ring.
Oh, so you think some of that, what I call, you know, what you could call like sort of the Rocky factor where he gets, you know, sort of, you know, taken away by the glitz and the glamour or whatever. You think some of that had an effect? Oh, interesting. How can it not?
Incredibly disciplined.
Yeah.
How can it not?
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Well, the reason
Dwayne
I asked.
Dwayne Johnson seems to be succeeding at it right now.
Right. But the reason I asked that in particular is because there was a line that you say in the piece about, you know, the most dominant figure in sports, and then something also the most dominant UFC fighter, not the most dominant female fighter, but UFC fighter. So it kind of like, it sort of shook me in a little bit of sort of like, wow, she was really like, not just within what she does as a woman, but just period in her sport and all of sports. And then here we are just a few years later. And I just was curious about that. And it was a very good piece it was really great. I love the process part too, where she gets you in a hold and you're on the mat and she's walking you through it. It's really, really well done, and people should Google it and check it out.
It's clear who was boss.
Yeah, I can see you. By the way, John, you tapped out a little quick. You know what I'm saying? I think you could have held out a couple more seconds.
I got bad shoulders.
Oh, there you go.
I'm not taking any chances. But I think that she, you know, we probably, maybe the way we defined her or that her success paralleled and her dominance paralleled what Mike Tyson was.
Yeah.
I remember Mike Tyson, you know, no fight lasted more than 30 seconds for a while.
Right.
And that's the way she was.
Yeah, that's true. You're absolutely right. And then it's just night and day. Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, it's HBO Real Sports. You can go to HBO Go to see this piece on NCAA coaching abuses, which just aired. Phenomenal show. It's an important show that should be out there. I think sports is the most influential part of our culture on kids for the most part, because it, you know, permeates every aspect and represents every aspect of our culture and us as people. So I think the work you guys are doing is really important. And I was really excited to have you on and talk about this. And, you know, whenever you want to come back on and talk about any other projects you have, please, please feel free. It's, I could talk to you all day. So, and people go see Hellfighters. They can, you can Google, it's a good piece, so check that out too. So,
Paul, you're so kind. It's really been fun. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on, and we'll talk to you soon, and hopefully come back on soon. All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. That was John Frankel. Hope you enjoyed it. Really cool guy. Great stories. This guy does amazing work. Please leave some comments on iTunes about the show, and you can check me out this weekend, May 3rd through the 6th. At the House of Comedy in Phoenix, Arizona. See you next week.